You're here this evening, and I hope you've got your Bibles already open to Hebrews chapter 12. If you don't, I want to encourage you to turn it there at this time, as we'll be using at least that passage for our beginning point in our lesson this evening. Here in Hebrews chapter 12, the Hebrew writer, as he encourages them to look out among themselves and to see those that are weak and struggling spiritually and can do what they can to help them out, as he talks about that example of what it's like to be a person that is like Esau, an individual who is profane, an individual, as he describes in this passage, as a fornicator. And he said, you need to look out among yourselves, and you need to act to strengthen these individuals, lest they end up like Esau. And as he describes Esau, he describes him in this passage as a profane person. And that's what I want to talk about with you for a few moments tonight, is a profane person like Esau. Who is Esau? You know, who is this character that he warns about? We're obviously familiar with much of his story. Why is it that he would be called a profane person? And what application of that is the Hebrew writer make here in this particular passage? And how is it that you and I could end up being like Esau and be described as a profane person? Individual. When we begin to think about a profane person like Esau, let's begin by first of all just asking, who is Esau? And no doubt most of us are familiar with this Bible character by the name of Esau. We're familiar with his strengths and some of his weaknesses. When we think about Esau, he is one of the firstborn, he was the firstborn son of Isaac and Rebekah. In the book of Genesis, chapter 25, Genesis, the 25th chapter, and beginning at verse 21, we read about the birth of Jacob and the birth of Esau, and it talks about how the Lord pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his plea. And Rebekah, his wife, conceived, but the children struggled together within her, and she said, if all is well, why am I like this? And so she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord told her that the two children within her were two nations. And they were going to be two people that were going to be separated from their body. One would be stronger than the other. And the older would serve the younger. And it said that when her days were fulfilled and she gave birth, indeed there were twins in her womb. And the first one that came out was red. And he was like a hairy garment all over. And so they called his name Esau. And so he is the firstborn son of Isaac and Rebekah, the twin brother of Jacob, who of course would become Israel. He was from a good family. There are a lot of things that we could say in terms of Esau, and even some of the mistakes that his parents made in rearing him and Jacob. But he was from a good family. In the book of Matthew chapter 22 and verse 32, when the Lord is discussing the question of the resurrection with the Sadducees, he said, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. That's Esau's brother, his dad, and his granddad. That when the Lord spoke, he said, I'm the God of those individuals. He's an individual that had come from a godly family, who had a father that feared and served the Lord, who had a grandfather who was the father of the faithful. He was a man that came from a good family, and they're found in the great chapter of faith of Hebrews chapter 11, beginning at verse 8 through verse 22. He was his father's favorite. One of the mistakes that Isaac and Rebekah made in rearing Esau and Jacob, that Jacob later would repeat in his own family, was the mistake of showing favoritism, having their favorite. And one reason the animosity and the hostility that developed between Esau and between Jacob was no doubt a result of that partiality. But in Genesis chapter 25, in verse 27 and 28, it said, the boys grew, and Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a mild man, dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. I don't take that to mean that they didn't care at all about the other one, but that this was the one they loved the most. This was their favorite. So he was his father's favorite among the children. And he was a man that had a history of being manipulated by his brother Jacob. He's a man that on more than one occasion was manipulated by his brother. There's a reason Jacob was given the name Jacob. He was a supplanter. He was a deceiver. In his early years, as he sought to gain some advantage over his brother. But first, when he sold his birthright to Jacob in Genesis chapter 25, Esau came in from the field. We'll go refer back to this story again in a little bit. But Jacob had been out hunting, didn't get anything, and he came in. And I guess like a lot of young people who hadn't had a meal in a little bit, he thought he was starving to death. And, you know, to him, he said, you know, if I don't get something to eat, I'm going to die. And Jacob had the red stew that was there that he had prepared. And he said, I'll let you have some for your birthright. And Esau reasoned that this birthright's not going to do him any good if I die. And so he gave him his birthright. But he was a man that was taken advantage of, manipulated by his brother. That's not to excuse, we'll talk more about this, Esau's decision to sell his birthright. Esau was wrong in that. But it's to say that both parties were involved in the mistake that was made in the selling of the birthright. And when he stole Isaac's blessing from Esau, Genesis chapter 27, verse 1 to verse 41, we're not going to read that whole story, but you know the story well. The time came for Isaac's blessing to be given to Esau. And Esau went out and was going to hunt and get his father some of the game that he liked to eat. And Jacob and Rebekah conspired together to steal the blessing. And so they took a young goat from the field and they dressed it and cooked it like it was one of the deer that Esau would have hunted and killed. They took that goat's hair and they glued it or attached it to his arms in some way and went in. And you may remember that Isaac is blind, couldn't see anything at that point in time. And as he came in, Isaac said, it's the voice of Jacob, but it feels like Esau. And he was convinced by Jacob that it was Esau, and he gave the blessing to him. Only later, after Esau returned, did Isaac realize the grave mistake that he had made. But he took his birthright, and he took the blessing from him. And so he's a man that had come from a good family. There was a family that loved to serve the Lord, but there were some problems within that family with favoritism. He had been manipulated by his brother. And he was the father of the Edomites. Rebekah was told that she had two nations that were in her womb. That is, that the two individuals were going to develop into separate nations. And that had to do with the nation of Israel that was going to come through Jacob, whose name would later be changed to Israel. And the nation of Esau, or the nation of Edom, that was going to come through Esau. Esau's name, by the way, was changed to Edom. In Genesis chapter 25, verse 30, or he was at least called to Edom in Genesis 25 and in verse 30, after he sold his birthright, he said, therefore his name was called Edom. The word Edom meaning red, and he sold that birthright for that red stew. And so two nations developed from it. And I think it's important later on as we study through the Bible and we talk about the interaction of the Israelites and the Edomites to keep in mind where they came from and why they were brother nations. And even some of the animosity that developed between them. He would later settle in the land of Seir, which Mount Seir becomes synonymous with the Edomites. And I want to say this about Esau. We begin to talk about he's a man with a good side. Now, we're going to say some very negative things about Esau in terms of being a profane person. I want to say this about Esau. Esau wasn't all bad. There were some good qualities to Esau. And maybe that helps us to appreciate the fact that somebody can have some good qualities and at the same time be an individual that may be described as profane or godless and unholy. You know, as many negative things we could say about Esau, he's a man that showed some kindness toward his brother who had deceived him. In Genesis chapter 33, in verses 1 through verse 16, we read about the journey of Jacob back to the land of Canaan. After he had spent the years laboring with Laban, and he was returning with his family and all of his children and the livestock that he had gained by the Lord's hand as he had labored with Laban. And he was absolutely scared to death, if you read the whole story. It's exactly, what is Esau going to do when I get back? You know, he had to flee because he feared that Esau was going to take his life. And so you can see in Genesis chapter 33 as he sort of puts the women in, the least favorite women and children in the front and the most favorite in the back. just in case something was going to happen as he came upon Esau. But in Genesis chapter 33, you can't help but be impressed with Esau, who, when he meets up with Jacob, is willing to let bygones be bygones. He's willing to put the mistakes of the past in the past, and as they fall and they have the tearful reunion, and he's willing to forgive Jacob for all that he's done. He's a man that in Genesis chapter 33 is willing to show kindness and willing to forgive and is willing to treat a brother who had done some very bad things toward him as if he never done those things. And so you have to be impressed with that, I think. He's a man that was willing to come together and help bury his father in Genesis 35 verse 29. It's interesting to me that we see these brothers that have been at it for so long that finally reunite in Genesis chapter 33, and when their father dies, there they are together, working to see that he's buried in the appropriate way. But for all the things we might learn in terms of facts about Esau, and even the positive things, what is said in Hebrews chapter 12 is that he was a fornicator. He was a fornicator, and it might indicate that he was guilty of sexual immorality. Some say it could indicate that he's one who broke his covenant with God, as is used in James 4 and verse 4, I tend to think of it in more of the sexual immorality that had characterized Esau's life. And it describes him as a profane person. And that's really what I'm focusing on in our study this morning. He's a profane person. What does it mean to be profane? It is a word that is translated in other translations as godless or unholy. I like the word profane. The word profane, the word that's rendered profane here in this passage, is a word that literally came from a Greek word that meant threshold. And it had to do with that upon which a person walked. You come into the house, walk through the threshold, you know, and it's just something that's just there to be trampled on, to be walked on. And that word that meant threshold then came to really just to represent that which was common. That which it was lawful to trample on or lawful to walk on. That which is accessible. And when it is applied then spiritually, we talk about profanity. One that's guilty of profanity. It describes one that takes something that is special. Something that is to be regarded as cherished. Something that is holy and treats it as something that is just common and ordinary. Something that is that is so worthless that you could walk on it, that it could be trampled on. And so, just as an example, we talk about profanity sometimes. We talk about language, taking the Lord's name in vain, or using profanity. And what that means is here are words or names that are to be treated with respect. They're to be treated as holy. And then when somebody takes a name like God or Jesus or other biblical ideas, and they just throw them around in their everyday conversation. They get excited, and they say, oh my, and they use the Lord's name. What they're doing is they're taking that which should be treated with respect, and they're treating it as something that is just common. Something that is not to be treated with respect, can be thrown around like any other word or any other name that's to be used. Well, that's the word profanity here in this passage, is that which is lawful to trample, that which is common. And it describes a man who had no real regard for what is holy and what was important. He had no regard for what was holy and what was important. Now, why is it that Esau would be called that profane person? If this is the description, somebody that has no regard for what's holy, no regard for what is godly, what is to be cherished, why is Esau called a profane person? Well, number one, he sold his birthright. We mentioned that already. We think about the birthright. The birthright, I'm the firstborn son. I'm the firstborn. And in our day and time, that carries no special significance with it. You know, you don't get a double portion when your parents pass away. You know, it's not really given a place of a prestige or honor. But we have to sort of understand the time they lived in. And if one was the firstborn, then that meant a double portion of the inheritance that the father was going to leave. In the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 21 and verse 17, he said, he shall acknowledge the son of the unloved wife as the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he has. For he is the beginning of his strength, the right of the firstborn is his. And of course, in Deuteronomy chapter 21, he's dealing with a situation where you might have a man with more than one wife, if we were to use Jacob later on as an example of that. and you have a wife that's loved, and you have a wife that's unloved. And that unloved wife was to give birth to a child first, and the firstborn son, that is, then he had the right of the firstborn. It didn't matter later on if his favorite wife or his loved wife had another son that he loved more. The right of the firstborn belonged to the one that was the firstborn son. And that meant a double portion of the inheritance. Now, for Jacob's family, that's a great amount. Genesis chapter 36, and verses 6 to verse 7. Genesis chapter 36 describes, at least to some degree, the great wealth that Esau would have inherited. He described Esau took his wives, his sons, his daughters, and all the persons of his household, and his cattle and his animals, and all the goods which he had gained in the land of Canaan, and he went to the country away from the presence of his brother Jacob. For their possessions were too great for them to dwell together, and the land where they were strangers could not support them because of their livestock. So Esau dwelt in Mount Seir. Esau is Edom. Now here together, they have so much they can't dwell together. But the point is, Jacob would have got, as that birthright, the double portion of what Esau had. I mean, we might illustrate it this way. The right of the firstborn was a blessing from God. Only one person can claim to be the firstborn son. But suppose that you saw a young man that came in from doing some task, and he was very hungry, and there was food on the table, and he said, "Well, I tell you what, for that mess of stew, I'll give you $2 million. That's all I've got, but I'll give you $2 million for it." We think, what a terrible bargain. I mean, it's not worth that. Here he's taking and giving this exorbitant amount for a mess of red stew. But in essence, what Esau exchanged was that double portion for one bowl of stew. And in doing so, he was guilty of profanity and showing disregard for the blessing that God had given of him being the firstborn and all the things that are associated with that. Not only did the birthright get the double portion of the father's inheritance, he had the rule and the authority over the brethren. He sort of became the patriarch of the family when dad passed off the scene. And so in Genesis chapter 27, and in verse 29, he said, "Let peoples serve you, and nations bow down to you. Be master over your brethren, and let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be those who bless you." Now that's a blessing that's pronounced on Jacob. But that's a blessing that was intended for Esau as the firstborn. But then the deception that took place, Jacob received. But the point is, as firstborn, he would have been the head of the tribe. He would have been the one that had the rule and the authority over his brother. And Esau took that, and he sold that for one bowl of stew. Not only did he sell the birthright, well, for that, instead of viewing it as something special, something to be guarded and kept, the Bible said he despised his birthright. He used it as something to be used just to buy a bowl of soup. And therefore, he didn't treat it as the special thing that it was. And he married foreign women, Genesis 37 and verse 34. He married Hittite women that caused his parents much bitterness. This would later cause them to send Jacob away in Genesis 28, lest he make the same mistake that Esau made. The Bible, by the way, does not go into great detail as to exactly how these women acted and what they did that caused such bitterness to Isaac and to Rebekah. I do learn from Genesis 28, that who your children marry can cause you grief. You know, when they choose poorly, it caused great bitterness to the soul of Jacob. I mean, to Isaac and to Rebekah. But he married these foreign women that were guilty of, that were no doubt involved in the idolatry and everything of the land. Now, in both of these decisions that Esau's noted for, there's one thing that characterizes both of these decisions. And that is, he chose the sensual over the spiritual. He chose the temporary over the eternal. In other words, he gave into the cravings of his hunger. He valued that stew more than he valued his birthright. Remember, that's what's said back here in Hebrews chapter 12. Don't be a profane person like Esau, who for one mess of porridge or stew, depending on translation, sold his birthright.
What did he do? He gave to the cravings of his hunger, and he valued the stew more than his birthright. And he chose the present over the future. See, instead of looking and saying, in the big picture, what is the impact of this decision? All the thing Esau was thinking about was right now. Whenever I think about the passage in the book of 2 Peter chapter 1 that talks about adding the Christian graces and not being short-sighted or nearsighted even to the point of blindness, I can't help but think of Esau. Every time I read that passage, I think about Esau, because here's a man that in the decisions he's making, he's looking right here. I'm hungry right now. So I'll get rid of my birthright and I'll get the stew. He concentrated on the sensual, over the spiritual, giving in to his cravings instead of thinking about what he was doing. And he chose the present over the future. Tossed away future rewards for present gratification. And so that stew may have taken his present hunger away. But what about the next day? What about after that stew wore off? What about the decision that Esau made? By the way, did you notice in Hebrews chapter 12, it talked about the decision that he made. He said that he found no place for repentance, though he sought it diligently with tears. And I think what that simply means is he couldn't undo what he had done, even though he regretted the decision looking back and realizing I made a terrible bargain. He couldn't go back and he couldn't undo that. Well, how does the Hebrew writer apply Esau's example? Now remember, here's this Esau. This man we're familiar with, who is called profane because in decisions he tends to concentrate on the central over the spiritual, the present over the future. And in doing so, shows disregard for the blessings of God. But now how does that apply to these Hebrew Christians to whom the Hebrew writer is writing? Well, if we look at the book of Hebrews, the entire book was written to Christians in danger of leaving the Lord to avoid persecution. Here are individuals that are serving the Lord in the midst of times that aren't easy. If we went through the book of Hebrews, we would notice such statements as their goods being plundered and being made a spectacle of. That's some of the things they had endured. And the Hebrew writer repeatedly emphasizes the need to hold on and to hold fast. You go through the book of Hebrews and you just see how frequently the Hebrew writer says, just hold on, keep on. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 3, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation, which at first began to be spoken by the Lord and was confirmed to us that those that heard. No escape if you neglect that salvation. Hebrews chapter 3, he talks about the example of Israel that fell away and said, let us therefore be diligent, lest we fall after the same example of disbelief and departing from the living God. Hold on. Don't be like the Israelites. Hebrews chapter 6 and 4-6, he talks about the danger of falling away and even coming to the point that it's impossible to be renewed back to repentance. Repeatedly throughout the Hebrew letter, the Hebrew writer is warning them, you hold on. Don't be among those that draw back to perdition. Don't be among those who give up and lose the things that they've been working for and lose these rewards. Run with endurance the race that is set before us. And in this immediate context, so what I'm saying, we look at this passage, we look at the larger context of the book of Hebrews. What's Hebrews about? It's about these Christians that are thinking about giving up and giving in because things are hard. Then we look at the immediate context here in Hebrews chapter 12, and he's discussing the need to help prevent others from falling away. And there's knees that are weak, and they need to be strengthened. And the hands that hang down. Look carefully lest anyone fall short of the grace of God. You keep your eyes on others and you try to help them lest they fall away from the Lord. I think it's one of the old Greek commentators that said about this passage that the picture of Hebrews chapter 12 is that of a grand caravan traveling. And the others in that caravan looking around and saying, is everybody in line? Is anybody falling out? And being sure that if there's anybody that's gotten out of line in that journey toward heaven, we try to bring them back in. And that's the picture of Hebrews chapter 12. Now here's the point I think that the Hebrew writer's getting at. You look through the book of Hebrews, and the Hebrew writer enumerates the abundant spiritual blessings that we enjoy in Christ. There's no fear of death, an aid in the time of temptation. There is the promise of rest, a sympathetic high priest, a sure and steadfast hope, a perfect high priest, the forgiveness of sins, the hope of Jesus' return for salvation. I mean, here are the blessings that we enjoy in Christ. If time permitted, we could spend our entire lesson talking about these spiritual blessings. But he delivered us from the fear of death, those who through all their lifetime were subject, those that were subject to lifelong slavery. He said in Hebrews chapter 2, he delivered us from the fear of death, having defeated him who had the power of death, that is the devil. He gives us aid in temptation. He promises us rest. Hebrews chapter 4, there remains therefore rest for the people of God, a time when we rest from our labors and rest from our works. He promises a sure and steadfast hope that we could trust what God says. He mentioned all of these wonderful spiritual blessings throughout the book of Hebrews. And the point the Hebrew writer, I think, is making here in this passage is when you had individuals like these Christians that are sort of standing at the crossroads and they've got a decision to make. You know what? We can continue the course. We can continue on and enjoy all these blessings that the Lord has to offer, or we can avoid this persecution. We can turn our back on the Lord and we can get out of this persecution and we don't have to endure all of that. But if they did that, they would have been guilty of profanity. They would have done the very thing that Esau had done. They would have chosen the sensual over the spiritual. They would have chosen the present over the future. And what the Hebrew writer says is we need to keep our eyes on one another, lest there become a person like Esau, who may be a fornicator, but also who got his vision out of kilter, if you will, by focusing upon the right now, as opposed to focusing upon the future and the long-term consequences of his decisions. When any time somebody chooses the world over serving the Lord, they're guilty of profanity. They're just like Esau. They've sold the birthright they have as God's children for a measly mess of porridge and a measly mess of stew. And in doing so, they've made a terrible, terrible bargain. Well, how is it then that we can be guilty? I think that's the Hebrew writer's application of Esau's example to these. Don't be like Esau and thinking about right now, but losing the side of the consequences of the decisions that you make. And by the way, when somebody makes the decision to leave the Lord or to choose the world over the Lord, like Esau, there will come a time when they will shed tears and wish they could undo that decision. But there will also come a time, like Esau, when those things can't be undone. And we now, as long as we're on this side of eternity, we have the opportunity to make the right decisions and corrections for the things that we've done. But like Esau, there will come a time in which it is too late. So how can we be guilty of profanity? In the remainder of the time we have, let's just mention a few things. Well, when we succumb to the passing pleasures of sin. Hebrews chapter 11, 25 to 26 talks about Moses who chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. If we go back to the story of Esau, I don't know how hungry Esau really was. I think the Bible indicates to us that he wasn't near as close to death as what he said he was. Or felt he was at the time. But I want to say this about Esau. I bet when Esau sat down, that stew tasted good. For a man that hadn't eaten, that had been out working in the field hunting, there's no doubt that that red stew was enjoyable. And I bet as he ate it, he enjoyed every bite of the stew that he ate, only to realize later that it wasn't worth what he paid for it. Now the Bible tells us that sin can offer some enjoyment and pleasure. If it didn't offer enjoyment and pleasure, by the way, it wouldn't be called temptation. That is the process by which we are led into sin. The fact that it is temptation means that it appeals to us. There's something about it that is desirable, something that we want. And the Bible tells us that sin can be enjoyable. But I want to tell you, like Esau, once the joy is over, we'll realize the price that we pay for the pleasures of sin is way too steep. It's way too much. The Bible tells us, for example, in the book of 1 John chapter 2 and 15 to 17, to love not the world nor the things that are in the world. For all that's in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life are not of the Father, but of the world. And the world is passing away in the lust thereof. But he that doeth the will of the Father abides forever. What's he saying? He's saying there that these things that are in the world, the lust, the desire of the eyes, the desire of the flesh, the desires of the vainglory of life or the pride of life, those are things that eventually are going to pass away. Same thing the Hebrew writer said, Hebrews chapter 11, talked about the passing pleasures of sin. Or I think, was it the old King James Version that said the pleasures of sin for a season? They're going to pass away. In 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 10, it said about Demas that he has forsaken me, having loved this present world. When we succumb to the passing pleasures of sin, when we sell our birthright as God's people for the pleasures of sin, we are guilty of profanity just like Esau. And again, like Esau, we'll realize someday that the price we paid is way too steep. When we choose to avoid persecution or ridicule, when we are faced with a decision, persecution is part of being a Christian. You know, one of the things that amazes me about the teachers, the Lord and the inspired teachers of the New Testament, is how completely forthright and honest they were as they preached the gospel. And telling people, you know, you need to be sure you're willing to count the cost and willing to pay it. And telling them, you know, that if you're going to join the Lord's army, you're going to have to endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. There's hardship and there's persecution in serving the Lord. And there are times in the midst of persecution that people give up and sell their birthright. In Matthew chapter 24, I think it's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in the first 34 verses of that chapter. But he said in verses 9 to verse 12 that because of lawlessness, the love of many will grow cold. I think what he's saying is as things got hard and things got difficult, and by the way, as the Romans came upon the city of Jerusalem, there were going to be Christians that were affected by that in the eyes of Rome. Sometimes the Jewish religion and Christianity were inseparably linked. Jews may not have viewed it that way, but the Romans sort of viewed it as an extension. And so there's going to be persecution. It's going to be difficult for those that were trying to serve the Lord. And when things got hard, there are going to be some that said, you know what, it ain't worth it. They were going to quit. They were going to throw in the towel. Because of lawlessness, the love of many will grow cold. And I tell you, when somebody forsakes the Lord because things are hard, in the midst of persecution, or to avoid ridicule at school, or they choose the path of sin, what they've done is they're guilty of profanity. They're just like Esau. They've sold their birthright for a measly mess of stew that is not going to be worth anything in the future. Not going to do anything in terms of their soul salvation. Romans chapter 8 and verse 12. Romans the 8th chapter. And in verse 12, the Apostle Paul said, in verse 12 of Romans chapter 8, verse 18 rather, I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory which shall be revealed in us. It's not worth comparing. It is worth anything you have to endure. And so when one has sold their birthright as God's people, have given up the inheritance that they would receive as part of the children of God in order to avoid the persecution and the ridicule and the mistreatment that goes along with being a Christian, they are guilty of profanity just like Esau. And it's as bad a bargain as paying $1 million or more for a bowl of soup to eat. How can we be guilty of profanity? When we allow material things to crowd out the spiritual, we're guilty of profanity. Now, Mark chapter 4. Mark chapter 4. In verse 18 and verse 19. Talking about the parable of the soils. Talks about the ones who sown among the thorns. They are the ones who hear the word and the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches and the desire for other things enter in and choke the word. And it becomes unfruitful. Here it describes people that have become so wrapped up in the things of this world, the things of this life, that spiritual things have become crowded out. That there's no room for that which is spiritual. Luke chapter 12 and in verse 15. Luke chapter 12 and verse 15. The Lord warned and said, take heed and beware of covetousness, For one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses. There's more to life than material things. There's more to life than the things of this world. Now, how many times have we seen, maybe in our own lives or maybe in the lives of others, those that are guilty of profanity because they allow the material to take precedence over the spiritual? What about the man that would choose a job that knowingly is going to keep him from his obligations to worship the Lord and to be the proper spiritual guide to his family, all to make more money? I tell you what he's done. He has sold his birthright for a measly mess of porridge. He's chosen the present over the future. He's guilty of profanity just like what Esau was. As parents sometimes, we wrap our children's lives up in the material. Things that aren't wrong in others. By the way, there was nothing wrong with eating stew. Nothing wrong with buying a bowl of soup, for that matter. And there's nothing wrong so many times with the things that we like to fill our lives with. But too many times, as God's people, we've allowed sports and other activities to so dominate our time that we have little time for the spiritual and little time to spend with the people of God and little time to pray together as a family, a little time to sit down and read the scriptures together. And when we do that, we are no different than Esau, who sold his birthright for some soup. I want to tell you, there come a time for young parents in their lives in which it's not going to matter how well Junior can catch a ball, or whether he was first string on the football team or baseball team. I mean, those things are wrong, and don't get me wrong. But there will come a time in life when you look back that those things aren't going to mean anything. But what will mean something is where the spiritual thing, where was the emphasis there? And you don't want to be like Esau and realize that you sold your birthright for a measly mess of porridge. That you thought about the present over the future. You chose the sensual over the spiritual. Don't be like Esau in the decisions that you make. How can we be like Esau? When we value human approval more than God's approval. John 12 and verse 43 describes those who loved the praise of men more than the praise of God. They knew who Jesus was. They knew they needed to follow him. They knew they needed to serve him. But when it came down to it, what meant more to them was whether man liked them or whether God liked them. And it was human approval was more important. And that can happen to any of us. Sometimes it can happen in the preaching of the gospel that we can begin to court human approval more than God's approval. Unfortunately, when we court that human approval more than God's approval, then we usually end up changing, watering down in order to gain that human approval. It can happen to anybody. Nobody that I know of likes to be disliked. And sometimes we put so much emphasis upon being accepted by men that we lose sight of what's really important, and that's being accepted by the Lord. The Apostle Paul said, if I'd be a servant, please men, I would not please the Lord. In Galatians chapter 1 and verse 10. There were those that were accusing him of being an apostle of men, not of God. And he said, do I persuade men or God? Or do I seek to please men? For if I still please men, I would not be a bondservant of Christ. I tell you, when I value human approval above God's approval, and the decisions I make, whether we're talking about at work or at school, in terms of what I teach, are based upon getting their approval more than God's approval. I have sold a birthright for a measly mess of porridge. I've looked at the present over the future, and I've craved that which is temporary and material more than I have that which is spiritual. How can I be guilty of profanity? We can go everywhere but services. We're guilty of profanity. I realize there comes times in individuals' lives when where people are sick and things can't be done in terms of attendance. But you know, I've observed in places where I have been that there are individuals that can go anywhere and everywhere they want to go. You know, if they need to go shopping, they can go shopping. If they want to go visit somebody, they can go visit somebody. But come service time, they never can be there. Think about a lady in a place I preached that you could see her keeping the road hot. She lived right down the road from us. And she kept the road hot. She could drive drive and do her shopping in 45 minutes from where we lived and be gone all day long shopping and all day long. And then come service time, you'd call her and she said, well, you know, I've got this health problem and I just can't go. Now, there's
not saying there's not such thing as health problems that prevent people from going to service. What I'm saying is when we are allowed to do everything and capable of doing everything and can make time for everything but come in and worship the Lord, what we're doing is we're guilty of profanity. We've chosen that which is less important over that which is more valuable. We've chosen the things of this world over the things of God. Hebrews 10 and verse 25 said that we're not to forsake the assembling of ourselves together as the manner of some is. Sometimes we said there are those that can do everything. And what they showed is they can't truly discern between what is holy and between what is unholy. They can't discern between what's truly, truly important. And so there are so many different ways that we could be guilty of profanity like Esau. By the way, Esau had his excuse. He's about to die. There's a reason for that profanity. But the Lord shows by how he describes Esau and the things that are said, there was really no excuse at all for what Esau did. What does it mean to be profane? To be profane, that word has to do with that threshold again. And it has to do with things that need to be respected and things that need to be honored and treated them as something that are no more than something to be walked on and trampled on. Do you remember, by the way, the passage in Hebrews 10? Hebrews chapter 10, where the Lord said that anyone who rejects Moses' law dies without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. Of how much worse punishment will you suppose he be thought worthy, who trampled underfoot the Son of God and counted the blood of the covenant, which he was sanctified a common thing. That spirit of trampling the Son of God underfoot, that's profanity that's being described there. In fact, I think some use the term profanity there to describe that they profaned the Lord. They treated it as something just to be walked on. Instead of that, which is to be valued. And there are so many different ways that you and I can be guilty of making the same mistake that Esau made. But what we have to do, instead of being like Esau, we need to focus on not just the today, but we need to focus upon the future. And ultimately, the judgment day. And how are the decisions that we make not going to affect not just today, but what's the effect in eternity? And I need to choose the spiritual over the material, the spiritual over the sensual. And realizing that sometimes that stew that's put before us tastes good at the moment. But later on, we'll realize that it's a terrible bargain to have sold that birthright we have as God's people with the inheritance that we shall receive, can receive, for that which is temporary in nature. Get your sermon books out. We're going to stand in just a moment. We're going to sing the invitation song. When we do, that'll be the proper time for one that needs to respond in obedience to the gospel. If you're not a Christian, you need to become one. You need to become one this very night because this is the only opportunity you know you're going to have. Do you believe in the Lord? Are you willing to repent of your sins, confess your faith in Jesus, be buried in the waters of baptism? If you're willing to do that, then you can come forward and have a seat on the front pew, and we'll assist you in rendering your obedience to the Lord even this very evening. And you can leave this place as a child of God. If you serve God faithfully, you can have a home in heaven. Or maybe there's somebody that's obeyed the gospel, but somewhere along the line you've sinned in a way that's known by others and brought public reproach upon the body of Christ, then you need to make a public acknowledgement of that sin. If that's what you've done, then we'll assist you in making the acknowledgement of that and praying with you and praying for you that God will forgive you. No matter what your need is, take advantage of the opportunity provided tonight. Respond to obedience right now so that we stand and we sing.